Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Reporting from New Westminster, BC, this is Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby. The City of New Westminster is currently developing a crisis response pilot project in order to help address the impacts of homelessness, poor mental health, and substance use in New Westminster. Three issues that, according to the city, have grown in prevalence over recent years. As stated by the city staff, the City of New Westminster's response to the three crises and associated externalities have been above and beyond. For instance, the city's sanitation crews are cleaning up human waste to a degree that they haven't before. By combining this work under one comprehensive strategy, we can address these crises in a meaningful way that takes into consideration everyone impacted. End quote. At a recent city council meeting, council voted on staff recommendations for the crisis response pilot project, which included the implementation of a safe inhalation site in the downtown core of New Westminster. The final vote was 5-2 in favor of the recommendations. To learn more about the potential impacts of having a safe inhalation site in New Westminster, CJSF got in contact with Jack York, board chair for the New Westminster Homelessness Coalition Society. He also has 14 years of clinical practice and leadership experience in social work regarding mental health and substance abuse. York recently spoke as a delegate during council in favor of safe inhalation sites being a part of the city's crisis response pilot project. The first question we had to ask him was, what exactly is a safe inhalation site?
A lot of people are familiar with safe injection sites, starting with InSight in the early 2000s. They've been around for quite a while, and there's a lot of literature and research that shows they're effective in ensuring people stay as safe as possible while using illicit substances, but also that they are a really good tool for connecting people to other forms of substance use treatment and service as well. And so we know that this model works, but what we have lacked for quite a while is a similar model for people who don't inject drugs, but rather smoke or inhale drugs. And for a long time, there hasn't been as much urgency for that because the rates of drug toxicity overdoses were lower for people who smoked and inhaled drugs than they were for injection drugs. But for a number of reasons, central among them, the fact that the toxic drug supply has continued to get more toxic, it's become a real issue. And now the majority of drug overdoses that take place in British Columbia take place in the context of smoking or inhaling drugs rather than injecting drugs. And so it's definitely an unmet need that there's a sense of urgency to meet at this time.
Can you get a little specific on just the way in which safe inhalation sites are structured? Are there separate rooms for people to inhale, or is it sort of like one central building or area? How does that work?
So I'll just give the caveat that I haven't worked and seen these inhalation sites myself because they didn't exist in significant numbers when I was practicing a few years back. And so they weren't accessible to my clients then. Since then, I was practicing primarily in Surrey. Since then, they have opened an inhalation site in Surrey. And I've had the opportunity to speak to people who have worked in these sites and who have designed these sites, so I can speak from that standpoint. But I don't want to make it seem like I've actually worked in these settings or seen them myself. However, typically there is a lot of thought put into things like the HVAC system, so the ventilation system that allows for the smoke to be cleared efficiently from the space in which people are actually using the drugs, so that they are as safe as possible, not only for those people who are using the service, but also for the staff that provide the service as well. Depending on each site, the way that they've structured the physical layout of the site might change depending on the space that they have, and considerations like whether or not there's like a booth or whether there's a shared space wherein people are using and are able to then interact with one another. And so I think there's a number of factors that impact exactly how these spaces are laid out, but there's a lot of thought put into making sure people are as safe as possible in these spaces, including the staff. And the inhalation site in New West, I'm confident, won't open until those safety considerations have been considered and addressed.
And a safe inhalation site in New West would be a part of the city's crisis response pilot project that's currently being worked on. And while it's been agreed upon that that is something that they should be moving forward with, it didn't have unanimous support among council. And I think one common argument against safe inhalation sites and even safe injection sites is that they have the ability to make the communities that they reside in less safe, and they sort of prioritize this model of harm reduction rather than recovery. Do you have anything to say to that?
Yeah, I certainly do. I think that there is this sense that creating a service like this will somehow draw in substance users and that that will create some kind of a safety risk. But the truth is that people who use illicit substances are already using them in the city. And in fact, they're using these substances often in the view of the public, in front of businesses, in settings that are more dangerous to them because they don't have the support that they need in order to use more safely, but also more dangerous to the general public and to other residents in the city. So that's the status quo that we're perpetuating by not providing a service like this. And I would argue that that's actually significantly more dangerous and harmful to our residents than having a safe place for people to go and use, where they're not having to have these potentially negative interactions with the general public and where they get the support that they need. In addition to that, I think in terms of just overall, systems within our region, so if people are using alone in a public space, they are much more likely to have a serious drug toxicity event that requires EMS to arrive, that requires potentially hospitalization and subsequent medical treatment. It involves more police contacts, which are costly and potentially dangerous to everyone involved. It involves more use of bylaw services and other city services that are all cost savings that at the same time as actually benefiting the substance user themselves. So I really think when it's really a common sense intervention and one that is that does serve the safety of the general public in a really important way, in fact.
Once again, that was our conversation with Jack York, board chair of the New Westminster Homelessness Coalition Society, who spoke in favor of the city's decision to include safe inhalation sites as part of New Westminster's Crisis Response Pilot Project. This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby. This segment would not be possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca.
This is ACHLY and CBOX News Update.
It was interesting reading the outcome live on video. I was trying so hard to be stoic and non-emotional as I read it. And I could hear, my council, the excitement behind me. And it was really hard to just not cheer right away. But just really interesting moment in history and in my life to be making that announcement was pretty amazing.
On March 8, 2025, Comox First Nation voted overwhelmingly in favor of ratifying both a constitution and treaty, achieving a double majority on each vote. 83% of votes were in favor of ratifying the Constitution and 81% were in favor of ratifying the treaty, with a remarkably high voter turnout of 91%. Nicole Rempel is Haygoos, chief counselor of Comox First Nation. She says elections for chief and council, which typically happen every 2 years, generally see a 40 to 45% voter turnout.
This is pretty phenomenal, but you are talking about a big moment in Comox First Nation history. It's a really historic decision to leave the Indian Act, leave something that we've known for 100 and however many decades, long years, to transition to self-government. So it was a really big decision for the community, and I'm really ecstatic to see the participation for such an important vote. I think, you know, nobody stayed home, and that's the important thing. Everybody's voice matters, and we will just bring everybody forward as we move forward.
This journey towards self-government is not new for Comox First Nation, with talks of this treaty beginning just over 30 years ago in 1994. Since then, the nation has made major advancements, like signing a land code in 2016, which replaced roughly a third of the Indian Act and allowed the nation to manage their own lands and resources. More recently, in 2024, the nation appointed Dr. Marion Buller as their own Justice of the Peace. The first in Canadian Indigenous history, this appointment gives Comox First Nation a means to recognize and enforce their own laws. The nation voting to ratify their constitution and treaty is a momentous step further.
Our ancestors didn't have a choice in being thrust into the Indian Act and having that control over them, being put on reserves and managed by somebody in Ottawa, and really dictated to on who could and couldn't receive resources, even though they were Comox. So being self-governing is really important for inclusivity and just ensuring that we bring all of our community and our membership along with us in this journey is really important. I'm a firm believer in equality and fairness for everybody. And so it's really an exciting time to see an opportunity like this, you know, and the vision of our nation to just explore the treaty and to really just take the chance and leave in the Indian Act.
Now that the Comox Treaty has been ratified by the nation, it must also be ratified by both the provincial and federal governments before Comox First Nation proceed to a signing ceremony they expect will take place sometime next year. Chief Rempel says one key difference in the Comox Treaty from the standard pattern is a 10-year review and renewal process, an opportunity every decade to assess and adjust the treaty if necessary. One challenge the nation faced preceding the March 8th vote was an injunction that descendants of the Salmon River Band filed to halt the process over concerns of land claim and title. The application was dismissed by the Supreme Court of BC, finding no irreparable harm would be caused by the vote, as it is one step in a long process. Chief Rempel says that Comox First Nation has always acknowledged the shared territory and resources within the Salmon River and is dedicated to finding new pathways to work together.
When we do work together, we have demonstrated an exceptional ability to succeed with our neighbors. So, you know, I'm hoping that we can sit aside one day and develop protocols together, having reasonable and respectful communications. Yeah, I would love to move forward. I think there just needs to be a willingness on the other side.
Contrastly, the Comox Valley Regional District, or CVRD, showed their support for Comox First Nation with public statements in solidarity and congratulations ahead of and following the March 8th vote. Chief Rempel says that the treaty team has been engaging with the Alliance of BC Modern Treaty Nations for many years, and one lesson from those nations' experiences was the significance of building relationships with local governments. Rempel says that this has been a priority since she was first elected in 2017.
The CVRD has been an outstanding and exceptional partner with Comox throughout the last number of years, since 2017, and maybe before that as well, but really partnering on projects together, especially around like sewer and water conveyance down to Union Bay to address their needs as well as Comox's. So it's been really fantastic to work with our local governments, and I really look forward to continuing to build those relationships.
Chief Rempel is also looking forward to the future this treaty could afford for future generations.
I have two children, they're 24 and 21, and to see them take an interest in their future and, you know, the future generations and really listening to them, I think was really important, listening to all of our youth, because this treaty isn't about my generation, it's about future generations and creating those foundations for their opportunities.
For CHLY and CVOX News, this is Heather Watson.
This report, in partnership with CVOX, was made possible with the support of the Local Journalism Initiative, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and listeners like you. You can find more news updates, interviews, and stories from our nonprofit newsroom, as well as our news and current affairs program, Midcoast Morning, at chly.ca/news.
This is Bird Note. As twilight deepens along a dry desert stream bed, a tiny owl peers out from a hole in a sycamore tree. It's an elf owl, the smallest species of owl in the world. Standing less than 6 inches tall, with gray feathers and big yellow eyes, the elf owl weighs less than an ounce and a half, a bit less than a golf ball. And they're determined predators. Flying out from its tree cavity at dusk, the elf owl hunts beetles, crickets, and spiders, plus the odd lizard or mouse. Larger prey, such as scorpions, with the stingers carefully removed, may end up cached in the nest for later dining. Elf owls live in woodlands and desert cactus habitats in northwest Mexico and along the border of the southwest U.S. They often nest in woodpecker holes in tall saguaro cactus. They depart their breeding range by October to central and southern Mexico, where insects are more available in winter. But spring comes early to the desert, and the minuscule owls return by late February or March, ready to begin their breeding season. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
Wandering Rhythms, Mondays from noon to two.
Join us in a weekly sample of music from planet Earth.
The strangest mixtape you will ever hear.
Desert blues.
Balkan punk.
Latin funk.
African psych.
Pigeon rap.
And anything and everything else you can imagine, equally represented by all continents.
Because good music is universal.
Wandering Rhythms.
Mondays at noon on CJSF 90.1 FM.
For the fourth consecutive year, the Two-Spirit Program at the Community-Based Research Center is calling upon relations, government officials, policymakers, hereditary leaders, and allies across Turtle Island to declare Thursday, March 20th, 2025, the spring equinox, as Two-Spirit and Indigenous LGBTQIA+ Celebration and Awareness Day in Canada. Jaylene McCrae is a proud Two-Spirit, sober Indigenous trans woman and leader within the 2S LGBTQIA+ and recovery community. A 60s Scoop survivor, she was raised by settlers with ancestral family roots in Treaty 4 Zagame Anishinaabek First Nation, Kawakatoose First Nation and Métis Nation, Green Lake, Saskatchewan. As a member of Vancouver's diverse and fabulous drag community, McCrae, known by her stage name Jaylene Time, holds the title of Elder Princess 27 of the Greater Vancouver Native Cultural Society, Empress 35 of Vancouver, BC, Tsarina of the First Nations of Canada, and presently serves as chairperson of the International Court Council, first in line of succession, heir apparent to Queen Mother I of the Americas, Empress Nicole the Great. Jaylene is a research coordinator with CBRC's Two-Spirit program. She also contributes to Indigenous healing ceremonies for the Two-Spirit population of Federal Justice System Corrections, and has shared teachings for Canadian government training on diversity, inclusion, and reconciliation. Thanks for joining me, Jaylene. Can you, for our listeners, let us know what is the Community-Based Research Center?
Yeah, well, it is a research center. So what it does is it really explores access points for healthcare and sexual healthcare for the 2S LGBTQIA+ communities. And, really continuing to explore different lived experiences and making sure that the reporting is accurate towards the lives that are lived today.
And why is it important to have a specific research group for these topics?
Well, I actually happen to be on the Two-Spirit program team. So this is something that I was brought into research, not in a generally speaking, how it would normally be done. For myself, I bring in a lived experience of navigating the world as an Indigenous trans person. And so I came into the program because the research company, and generally speaking, it is an academic world. And for myself, I really value the fact that the organization made a commitment to really including different voices and different viewpoints and different contributions towards the work that we do. And I think that that is something that I think is really important, is we just need to really make sure that we continue to share the stories and the voices and the experiences of all our people within our queer communities, and just to make sure that the reporting is accurate towards that and moves forward to bringing access to more people.
When and how did you get involved with the community-based research center?
I attended a symposium that the Two-Spirit program was hosting, and I was invited to be a speaker at it. And I actually, to be quite honest, I hadn't been in a room full of all Two-Spirit people before. Mm. And I was really impacted by that, to be sharing stories and to also witness a group of people that were really taking care of that environment and presenting information about healthcare, but also about support for our communities, remote and urban. And I just felt like, oh, this is something that feels really good. And I had previously been working in a college, working in the art community as a makeup artist and instructor. And I actually just felt like I needed to have a shift. The feeling that I had was I need to show up and be part of a resurgence of Two-Spirit empowerment, but also the healing journey that is really important for Indigenous people. And so that's sort of how that happened. It was really just a shift of an experience that I had that moved me and inspired me to show up in a different capacity.
What does your work within the Two-Spirit program entail?
The work that I do with our team is, number one, be visible. So we show up with different stories of lived experience. For myself, as an Indigenous Two-Spirit transgender human being, also I'm a 60 scoop survivor. I've also been sober for, I'm in my 27th year of continuous sobriety. I also am a trans person. And so just being able to navigate my existence in this world has been, you know, I've learned a few things along the way. And, you know, I think that is something that is really important. We all bring our own dynamics of our stories, the stories of our nations, the stories of our hopes, of what's important to us. And, you know, I think just the balance of those experiences make a real important group of people that not only can come together and support policy, but we can also go together as a unit and visit the nations and have talking circles and really listen to how we can help people in many different ways.
Yeah, you mentioned never having been in a room full of just Two-Spirit people, and that visibility. I have to imagine that being able to go out into communities and provide that experience for other people is huge. You're here today to talk about a call to make March 20th officially the Two-Spirit and Indigenous LGBTQIA plus Celebration and Awareness Day. What can you tell me about that?
Yes, well, this actually, it has now been recognized by our province as Two-Spirit Day. And that is something that is really exciting because it is now expanding across Turtle Island. So in different communities, they're hosting events to recognize the spring equinox as Two-Spirit Day. And we do that annually. And we're just working to really push for the resurgence of our visibility, but we can't do it alone. And I think that's one of the things, is that we encourage our community partners as well that are building community and brave spaces for people to access support resources, a plethora of resources for people to access for just their daily health care, for support in their career development, also sexual health care testing, a bunch of things that are really important, specifically with our legislation now. It's important. I'm part of a campaign called Drag Out the Vote as well. It's just making sure that people are aware that we need to get out there and vote, because as we see across the border, you know, there's a lot of targets towards the identity of the 2S LGBTQIA plus communities, the trans communities, the gender affirming care. All these things are really at risk. And so it's important that we have a presence that is strong and that feels confident to be able to show up together to really define the importance of strengthening diversity in our communities. And actually, it's life-saving.
Yeah, absolutely. That community is so important in that building those connections.
Yeah, so Two-Spirit Day for us, it does fall on the spring equinox. When you think about it from a Indigenous way, it is a time when we're going from winter to spring, to where the season's changing, to where we can take our learning opportunities and our storytelling to the land, because we can now go out, the weather changes and, you know, the sun comes out and the plants come out, so we're able to really be on the land. So, you know, that's really, traditionally, that's what that shift means, is being able to take our teachings and come together. And that's exactly what we're doing, is like we're just taking to the land, coming together, and we're recognizing the importance of having a lot, because the reality is a lot of Two-Spirit people have been displaced from culture because of colonization. So they haven't always been welcomed into the circle. And that is shifting and that is changing. And we want to just really welcome people who haven't felt connected and haven't felt that support, just to like reaffirm that we're here and we're finding each other. And when we have days of recognition like this, it also boosts a level of pride in us that says, yes, we're here. We've always been here. We're not going anywhere. And now we just need to hold our communities accountable to recognizing this.
I think that ties into this year's theme, which is access. What does that mean to you in the context of Two-Spirit Day?
Yes, well, access to me, I think of a large tree, and I think of the branches, and I think all each of those branches should lead to a resource of support. It's life. Those branches represent life, and they lead towards the support that we need as people, as human beings, as Indigenous Two-Spirit people, like I mentioned, to our healthcare access, towards sexual health. And for myself, I identify as a stigma buster and a Sir Thriver, in a sense that I want to have conversations with people that are authentic and real and gritty and vulnerable, important. And I think access is about being able to come together and say what you need to say without the fear of judgment. I think for so long, we have learned through generations that there's only certain things that we can say, and there's certain things that you don't say, and it's not going to be welcomed. And for myself, I'm like, if it has to do with the well-being of this journey of self-discovery, then it's welcome. And so this is what we're doing. And on our Two-Spirit Day is we collaborate with a local community hub that welcomes every demographic of people, the Birdhouse in Vancouver. And it is a space that is like a club, but it is like queer and trans owned. And they welcome many different members of our community to come here. And they really support also empowerment and also learning opportunities. And that's what we do too as well, is we create a space of fellowship, but we also provide different discussions that, you know, tackle some important issues. Like this year, we're going to be discussing gender-based violence and art-based therapy and some of the different pathways to healing for that. And so we're coming together and we're going to have like bannock and some foods and some drag performances of Two-Spirit artists, and also a testing hub from Health Initiative for Men as well. So we're going to have a nurse on there to discuss what STBBI testing and also some vaccines as well. Just access is making sure that when we come together in a good way, we're loving, we are exploring, and we are recognizing and honoring the people that came before us and reawakening. And we do realize that that healing journey is not just us. It is seven generations of our people, of our ancestors, that we are rising up for as well.
You mentioned this celebration addressing gender-based violence. How is that going to be tackled in the context of the events, and why is it particularly important to do so?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say tackled. I would say explored and defined. Because I find there's a lot of people that don't even really realize that they have been victims of gender-based violence. Because I'll speak for myself, at a young age, I just kind of figured out, you know, work really hard, don't expect much, and know your place. And so I just got on with it. And I think it's normal. So you just get through being treated a certain way and you navigate with that experience. You don't even realize that you deserve better. And so I think that having a discussion that defines what gender-based violence means, what lateral violence means within community, these different ways about how to define that, and to be able to have access towards having a discussion of support on, well, how does one even, once you've defined it, what does that healing journey look like? Because people have different capacity for different ways to learn about things, but also comfort levels of what environments they feel safe in. And so it's a discussion that is a community-based environment, and it's going to be led in a good way by some of our community leaders, including myself and also a representative from Health Initiative for Men. And also we have an elder, Sheila Nyman, who does ceremony and has worked as a counselor for gender-based violence. And we also have an art-based therapist coming as well. Her name is Jillian Bagan. And so we're working together with different experiences within that topic to provide a support, but also just to open a discussion so that people can understand a little bit more on how we can show up in community with some new findings and some new pathways to support.
You've touched on it a few times, but what do you hope that people who might attend this event, this celebration, will take away from it?
That's a great question, because I hope that people who attend will realize that it takes all of us to create growth and empowerment. All of us, every walk of life. Just showing up is an action of allyship, I believe. It's like sometimes people ask me, well, how can I help? How can I be part of? It's if you see an event, one thing I love about it too, speaking of access, is that the Birdhouse, for all their events, there isn't a barrier for cost for people. So they're like, for certain events, if there's tickets, like for example, the day event, it's free. So everyone can come, all ages. And then there's a dance event at night. There's tickets there, but also if budget is an issue for people, there's also a sliding scale as well. So, I mean, pay what you can. And I think that is just so important. And that's an action of allyship. That's saying we don't want anyone left behind. We want you to come and be part of this. And if you're able to be able to support that, do it in the way that you can. And I think that is so healthy. I think that is so beautiful. And I think that, you know, I have an amazing life today. I want to recognize that. Like I'm so grateful for being able to walk this earth today. And I just feel this real need to share it and to create pathways for people following so that they can, you know, get to know themselves and build that confidence, maybe at a younger age than I did, you know, and just be able to have that support and feel it and realize that the power inside of them is to be them. And the only limit of what they can achieve in this life is their imagination. That's really important to me.
Great. Can you give the details about the event at the Birdhouse, where, when, how people can find out more information?
Yes, it is on Friday, March 21st from 12 until 6 p.m. at the Birdhouse in Vancouver. And that is a day event that will include a pipe ceremony, also going to be doing a welcome from Elder Sheila Nyman. And then we're going to be having some community people share what Two-Spirit Day means to them. And then we're going to be having the workshop discussion, art-based. There's going to be lots of arts and crafts there, and to have a discussion about gender-based violence as well. And then after that, we're going to have some drag performances for some local performers, but also the winner of Canada's Drag Race Season 5, the Virgo Queen, is going to be there as well. And myself, Miss Congeniality from Canada's Drag Race Season 5, and Zana, and from Ilona Verley, and Theoretical, and Ella Lamara from Call Me Mother. So there's just going to be a whole bunch of really welcoming energy of diverse artists, a space where, like I said, there's going to be Bannock there, there's going to be discussion, just a friendly place to come in and, you know, recognize this day.
And I think it sounds really great how there is such a wide variety of approaches and activities and even just sort of like moods and topics. You know, you've got some more serious topics and you've got some fun as well, some celebration as well as some introspection.
I like that you said that. Because I look at things, I try not to look at things as really serious. You know, I think that we would generally speak to think about when we talk about life, it can be serious. And I think that I tried to think about navigating through a medicine wheel of balance, in a sense that this is life. And I want to feel good through anything that I face in this journey, right? And I think that when we come to a space and we have discussions, as a matter of fact, we take away the weight of that serious and just say, oh, this is just what we experience. And when we come together, we learn from each other. And we're able to get out there into the world and realize that we can feel good and we can feel in balance through anything we have to face. I just feel that that is such a great place to kind of navigate together. And just to know that there's power in our unity, there is strength in our truth, and there is freedom in the flow of we're going to be okay.
Great. Well, thank you, Jaylene, for taking the time to chat with me today. Is there anything else you think people should know?
Well, I just want to let people know that everything you kind of need to navigate your own experience is within you. And I just love that, because the more people I meet, you know, the more people we connect with, and when we listen to each other's stories, you just realize, oh, you have that in you. It's just kind of like building confidence around people to say that you're the perfect you. And just keep exploring, keep looking out for things that you see online that inspire you, that make you feel good, and gravitate to those stories until you can really foster this confidence to share yours. And I think because that's the way, it's like, just keep, what did they say in Finding Nemo? Just keep swimming.
Yeah.
Just keep moving forward, because there are a bunch of people out there that feel exactly the same way as you do. And when we find each other, we go back to that really enjoying this journey.
Well said. Thanks again for your time today.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
That was Jaylene McCrae, research coordinator with the Community-Based Research Center's Two-Spirit program. On Friday, March 21st, Jaylene and the CBRC will celebrate Two-Spirit and Indigenous LGBTQQIA+ Celebration and Awareness Day with an all-day event at the Birdhouse at 44 West 4th Avenue in Vancouver. For more information about the event and about the Community-Based Research Center, visit cbrc.net. For CJSF 90.1 FM, I'm Jesse Wensloff. This interview is made possible by funding from the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this and other stories from around the country at frequencynews.ca.
welcome to another edition of Gardening with Embark. I'm pleased to have Pablo Vimas of Embark Sustainability joining me. And we're going to be talking today a bit more about planning your garden for the year and things you need to be considering. So what did you want to tell us about today, Pablo?
Hi, good morning, everyone. Nice to be here. Last week, we talked about garden planning. And part of that garden planning was to have a definition, a direction, and a purpose of our garden. So if we are going to do a vegetable garden, for self-consumption, and a vegetable garden that will produce vegetables year-round. So that is the main purpose. Once we have our purpose and that definition, the next step is to think which gardening method or approach I'm going to use it. Most of us say I'm doing organic gardening, which is it's a part of a gardening method that we are going to use. So depending on the space that we have or you have in your where you are gardening, be this the balcony, a terrace, a community garden, here there's a few a gardening plot that will help you to identify which gardening approach you are going to use.
And you gave me a list of different approaches, and there's actually a lot more than we can talk about this morning. But
absolutely, there are so many gardening approach. I think the one that we are very much used to is the traditional row gardening, planting our vegetables in a row, kind of a something what is done in the farming, in when you have a farm, long rows of same vegetable. Gardening, sometimes we try to bring this farming thinking into a small space. So, but it, there are other approaches such as a double duck bed. If you are in a community garden, we have the raised beds. What we do here in SFU, we have our raised beds full of soil. We can have the square foot gardening. That was something that came in 1970s. A straw bale gardening. So we have the straw bales and we make holes in there, put a bit of soil, and we plant our vegetables into it. If you have tree trunks or any kind of wood lying around, you can pile them up covered with soil. And that is a German method called the hagaculture. We have the root stouts mulched garden. So everything, the soil is always protected with mulch. And then we have the lasagna garden, lasagna gardening, which is a method where you create, you build your soil by layering compost, green gardening trimmings, cardboard, soil, and so on until you build your own soil.
Right.
On top of that, we have container gardening, small pots, big containers, so it's again. And then we can go to a more complicated systems like a core gardening, landrace gardening, forest gardening, polyculture, perennial gardening. Oh, that is interesting. We have some perennials in our garden, but a garden that is fully made of perennials like asparagus, chives, onion chives, garlic chives, kale. So that will be kind of considered just a perennial garden.
Yeah, so does that mean that, like, ordinarily when we're talking about, you know, seedlings and planting, we put them in, is this where you're planting things and then the plants just keep coming up and your job is to keep maintaining and encouraging that rather than planting new plants each year?
Yes, so perennial gardening is you plant plants that year after year they keep producing. Yeah. Kind of asparagus, you plant and you wait for 3 years and then you have your first harvest. And after that, you harvest year after year. The same happens with herbs like mint, rosemary, oregano, sage, thyme. So that's part of the perennial gardening.
Right.
Then we have a more friendly approach like a no-tilling or zero-tilling gardening, natural farming, again, trying to work with the nature, not disturbing much the soil. And we know that nowadays as well, we have a very much plant-based population is increasing. And therefore, the vegan garden has come up. And with vegan garden, it's like we try to keep any animal byproduct out of the garden. So rather than using cow manure or horse manure, we will be using green manures, which is we will start planting legumes like peas, beans, and when they are in a certain stage, we mix them into the soil. So that we have the vegan garden, okay? if we don't have a space outside, we can start our indoor garden, which we call the countertop gardening. Countertop gardening in the kitchen, we can grow microgreens, we can grow mushrooms, we can grow pots with herbs. So that's countertop gardening, bringing the garden inside in small pots and containers. So those kind of, as you can see, there are a lot of gardening methods. And on top of that, we have philosophies that we like to follow, such as the biodynamics, doing our gardening by following the moon cycle. And the moon cycle, when it's full moon, we do these activities. When it's new moon, these other activities, and in between, different kind of activities. So that is scheduled according to the moon calendar, how the moon phases move. Then we can have the permacultural principles, the principle of care for the plants, care for the air, care for the people, and fair sharing. So it's again, it's all that vision and philosophy. And nowadays we have the regenerative agriculture, which as well it becomes into part of the gardening, which is building the health of the soil, caring for the soil, building soil, and a healthy soil brings healthy plants. And finally, we have a new one. It's called the Perelandra system, which is try to understand what nature is doing, try to understand and read nature and bring that understanding to our own garden.
That's a lot. I mean, you know, as someone who's not steeped in sort of gardening knowledge, it's sort of surprising and interesting to see all these different approaches. A lot of people are putting a lot of thought into this kind of thing.
Yes, there is. I mean, people have been gardening for centuries.
Yes.
And everyone comes with their best approach according to the space they have. If you have a poor soil, there is not much to garden on, so you will go decide to build your own soil and say lasagna gardening is my gardening method, and then you start building that. And if you have a soil that is, you don't know whether it has chemicals in there or you don't know the past use of that land, you might try to go to another system that helps to build the soil. And in urban environments, we have that not much space to grow openly. So we are restricted to container gardening.
Right. So for many people, they've done some gardening, they learned some stuff. Where do you recommend people sort of get started with?
Yes. So here in SFU, we have our growing raised beds, which are metal beds, 24 inches tall, 4x4 feet wide. We use the raised beds. This has the ability that the soil warms up very quick over the spring, and combine it with a square foot gardening. So, which means that we have a 16 squares because it's a 4x4 feet. So we have 16 square feet, and in those square feet in that space, we use the square foot gardening to densely plant our crops. And we go through a process of planting and harvesting. So during the season, we are really planting and harvesting. And we are very busy because the garden keeps producing. So this is what we do here at SFU. We use the square foot gardening approach, which is lots of information on internet. There are plenty of books published about that. There is a foundation, the Square Foot Gardening Foundation. So there is lots of information, and it's very, very simple.
If someone's a relatively new gardener, I'm thinking, you know, maybe they have a yard, maybe they can get a plot at a community garden. Mm-hmm. So they have options in terms of the scope, but what do you recommend they start with? Because I imagine, because you're mentioning that, you know, it can take a lot of work. It can be very easy to take on too much. So, and how much space would you recommend people, especially if they're maybe relatively new, like one box is lots or?
Yeah. So that is why the square foot gardening approach comes in to help us to identify how much I'm going to plant. For instance, in a square foot, we can plant 16 carrots. Okay, 16 carrots. If you plant two squares, you have 32 carrots. How many carrots we eat a week? if you remember, try to remember this: how many carrots comes in a bunch from the supermarket?
Yeah,
3-4 carrots in a bunch. So that is your. You can say that you have 4 carrots a week. You have 16 carrots waiting to be harvested. So you have a full carrots for a month.
Right.
So the square foot gardening helps us like that. With lettuce, for instance, we have 5 lettuces in a square. How many lettuces we eat a week? 2, if we are really into salads. So we have already 2 weeks of worth of lettuce in the garden. So that is what I like this method, because it helps me to understand how much space I will be planting of the same vegetable.
Right. Yeah, that's really interesting. So to think of it as your shopping list of, and your garden is your grocery store, and you're going to try and produce, you know, what you can use and not way, way more.
Yes. Because so in the garden, we plant what we like to eat, what we consume most.
Yeah.
And based on that, we try to scale. I mean, if I like lots of carrots, lots of beets, for instance, beetroot, we have 9 beets in a square foot.
Yeah.
And I think when you go to the supermarket, you get by the unit. So you can buy 1 or 2 beets.
Yeah.
So you have 9 beets there, all coming at the same time, ready to be eaten.
Right.
Yeah. And with the spinach, we plant 9 spinach per square. So, so it's quite helpful, this system. I like a lot. In contrast with the single row, where you just make a drill on the soil and you sprinkle your seeds.
Yeah.
And then you will have to remove the seeds in between, so leaving all the big plants. And you can really get a lot of plants in a small space. And then all plants are fighting for a space, nutrients, sunlight, water. Yeah.
All right. Well, lots to take in. So gardening methods and principles, I think people can probably look on the internet to find out more about that, because we talked about a lot of different stuff. We'll be continuing to talk a bit more about garden planning in upcoming weeks.
So next time we will be talking about gardening seasons. It's interesting, right? Because the successful of being a good gardener is to match the vegetables with the season.
Excellent.
If there is a mismatch, we are setting ourselves for failure.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Pablo Vimas. Tell me a bit more about how people can find out about Embark Sustainability.
Embark Sustainability is a nonprofit organization based in SFU campus, and you can find us in our social media using our handler, Embark Sustainability.
Thanks so much, Pablo.
Thank you very much.
Back with Gardening with Embark next week.
See you then.
This is a CHLY and CBOX news update.
With music, your curiosity is never over, because there's always something else to check out. So it's a way of traveling the world, in a way, through different cultures, through their music.
Kip and Karen, spouses and co-owners of Bop City Records in Courtney, are launching a brand new community music fund to support the local music scene. Bop City Records sells new and used CDs, records, and cassettes, and sometimes when patrons bring in collections to sell, they opt not to take the cash or store credit offered in exchange. Co-owner Kip Luce explains how, as a for-profit business, it felt important to find a way to give that back to the community.
I always feel a bit weird about taking tips or freebies, and I explain, well, we're a business, so we want to pay you out. And then we realized, well, maybe we can just turn that money that people don't want into something good. And we wanted to do something charitable, but also something music-related and something community-based. And so basically the idea of the fund was born, that you know, we can try to support one or two projects a year, and it could be anything.
Lou says the fund is open-ended, and Bop City's co-owners will consider applications for anything to do with local music.
So it could be for education, it could be for recordings, it could be for anything related to releasing physical media, it could be for live events, so anything music related. I mean, I've met people that have sort of taken instrument building classes. Well, if you want to take an instrument building class and it's out of your budget, that could be something that we could help with.
Luce anticipates that with the current scale of the fund, they will be able to support one or two projects once or twice a year. He says that they have already received a few quote-unquote really good applications since announcing the fund.
There's been all kinds of really cool ideas out there. There's going to be a lot more great ideas than there are dollars to support it, which is a nice problem to have.
Luce says the motivation for this community music fund comes from a desire to support local rather than donate to a music charity somewhere else in the world. He credits local musicians and music fans for the support that has kept Bop City Records open for 31 years.
There's lots of ups and downs. You know, the world's been a topsy-turvy place with COVID and now with the orange one. And so it's been a trying time, you know, for various reasons to be a small business person. But we just keep trucking along and we learn as we go and we make it up as we go along and we're just having a great time.
Luce says one of his favorite things is watching customers who come in and guessing what they will buy.
And I love it when I'm totally wrong, or if they have, you know, they've got some Hawaiian guitar music, they've got some metal and they've got some bluegrass. And I love the diversity of people's tastes, and I love trying to figure out what they want, but I also love surprising them with new sounds too. Often somebody walks in and they kind of have this stunned look on their face and they're looking at my speakers and they're standing there and they say, well, what is this? I need it. And so that's part of the fun too, is just introducing people to new stuff.
Luce says that since buying the business 8 years ago, he and his co-owner have noticed a real shift in the diversity of patrons and their tastes in music.
I think that partly is the valley is diversifying. People are coming from other cities and other countries and other provinces. And the next generation, the younger kids are getting into physical media as well. And so we've really found our customer base is diversified. So we're happy about that.
When asked about the importance of community, Luce said,
everyone wants to be a member, feel like they're a member of a community. And the more you have that, the richer your society is. And so that was one of the important things that we wanted this fund to sort of be about, is being able to say, hey, okay, we value whatever you're doing. Give it a shot. It's worth trying. Somebody's going to love it. You're going to make yourself and other people happy. And if we could throw a little bit of money at that, that's great.
Those interested in applying for the Bop City Community Music Fund have until Monday, March 31st to submit. Applications are available to pick up at Bop City Records or can be requested by email at bopcityrecords@gmail.com.
Music is just sound that hits your brain. But it's also some magical thing that transforms your body and your mind. And it conveys a message sometimes, but it also... I don't know. It's some kind of little bit of magic in life that I can't really put my finger on, but I can't get enough of. I can't live without. I mean, I suppose if I went deaf, I would learn. But it's just inexplicable, really.
The music playing in the background during this interview is a local trio, Air Above Mountains, who perform improvised music.
If you see them live, it's a bit of a feast for the eyes because they play about 18,000 different instruments, and the guitarist sort of puts his guitar on his lap and beats it with mallets and does all kinds of fun things with pedals and effects. And you're not too sure what you're hearing, and it's just a trip. They've got a number of albums out on CD and vinyl, and it's kind of one of the Valley's best-kept secrets, actually.
For CHLY and CVOX News, this is Heather Watson.
This report, in partnership with CVOX, was made possible with the support of the Local Journalism Initiative, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and listeners like you. You can find more news updates, interviews, and stories from our nonprofit newsroom, as well as our news and current affairs program, Midcoast Morning, at chly.ca/news.
curious, something cultural, something unserious, sometimes serious, something mundane, something everyday, though not even really that. Tune into Typically Tuesdays, airing every Monday. You heard that right, Monday. From 3 to 4 p.m., your hour of quasi-cerebral talk and tunes.